Sorry, start again there. You may have not listened, heard my introduction there. Welcome to the Hellenic Observatory's first research seminar of 2022. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you and also to wish you Happy New Year to a new series of research seminars. And what better way to kick off our research seminar series than to have a talk by two of my, if you want, favorite colleagues who write about contemporary Greek politics in a way which has really broken ground and made it accessible to comparative politics students and colleagues across Europe in a variety of different ways. The theme of today's presentation is crisis management within government, Papandreou and Tsipras compared. Our speakers today have in the past collaborated on an extremely important volume called Prime Ministers in Greece, The Paradox of Power, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2015. In this particular book, our speakers argue that there were enduring features of how governments were run from the center across time, political parties and leaders. Today, in this seminar, they consider how Papandreou and Tsipras, faced with certain constraints, managed the Greek debt crisis in its two most decisive periods. How did their individual leadership styles impact on the management of the particular crisis? Now, the speakers, I will introduce them, but they don't really need any introduction to this particular audience today. Kevin Featherstone is the Eleftherios Venizelos Professor of Contemporary Greek Studies and a professor in European politics in the European Institute at the London School of Economics. And of course, he's also the director of the Hellenic Observatory, which is hosting today's talk. His list of publications is endless, and I'm not going to go through it for the purposes of saving time. But he is, of course, somebody who writes not only about Greece, but more importantly about Greece in Europe in the context of broader European politics. Speaking with him today is a long-term collaborator of Kevin's and also a very close friend of the Hellenic Observatory, Professor Dimitris Papadimitriou, who is Professor of Politics at the University of Manchester and Director of the Manchester Jean Monnet Centre for Excellence. Dimitris has a long-term affiliation with the Hellenic Observatory. He's also held visiting posts at Princeton and Yale and elsewhere. He, like Kevin, of course, has a deep interest in writing about Greek politics and public policy, but he also has published widely in other areas of European politics and political economy, as well as the EU's external relations, and especially in relation to the Western Balkans. So I welcome you both to today's talk, and I'll hand over to you in a second, just after I've made a few little housekeeping announcements. For those of you who want to tweet, today's hashtag is #LSCGreece. The event is being recorded, and once the recording is complete, we hope to make it available as a podcast to be posted on the Hellenic Observatory website for your use at a later stage. Our speakers will be speaking for approximately 30 to 35 minutes, and there will be plenty of time afterwards for discussion and questions and answers. For those of you who are participating via Zoom, please pose your questions through the question and answer function at the bottom of your screen, and I will collect these questions and try and find, make sense of them in terms of the themes, and then put them to the speakers for them to answer. When posing your questions, I think it's very useful for all of us if you could state your name and give us an affiliation so we know what kind of institution you may come from or where you may be located in the stratosphere. For those of you who are watching on Facebook, please add your questions as comments. So that's me done in terms of introducing the topic and introducing our speakers. And without any further ado, let me hand over to Kevin Featherstone and Dimitris Papadimitriou, who will take us through their talk on crisis management within government, Papandreou and Tsipras compared. Dimitri, over to you.
Thank you, Spiro. I will actually starting. No problem. Thank you very much for the kind introduction, and thank you to the audience for joining us. I look forward to the discussion later. So the question we're focusing on tonight can be starkly put: do crises centralize decision-making? it's a generic question, but we're applying it, of course, to Greece, which is a good social science perspective on a Greek case study. But this is our first presentation of the research. The research is ongoing. And so we very much look forward to the discussion afterwards, your questions, challenges, comments, whatever. As Spiros has mentioned, in our book, Prime Ministers in Greece, The Paradox of Power, published in 2015, we showed that all governments in Greece, from 1974 until we finished our study in 2009, had experienced a machinery of government problem, undermining their capacity to act. That is, all such governments suffered to a greater or lesser extent from two problems: poor coordination and a lack of control from the center within government. So we said there was a paradox. The constitution of Greece, and indeed popular opinion, often assumes that the prime minister is exceptionally powerful. But in reality, the mechanics of the prime minister and his aides being able to control and coordinate was limited, we argued. Government departments acted as fiefdoms or silos cut off from the center. The institutional processes weren't there to coordinate better. The prime minister didn't have the resources to penetrate the machine better. Ministers and ministries had other interests. So despite the variations in leadership style, in party and power, in ideology, this structural problem had endured and appeared to be endemic to the Greek system. And as I've indicated, our study finished with the prime ministers up to the year 2009. Well, of course, since 2009, Greece experienced the mother of all crises. So tonight, we're asking the question, what was the impact of the Greek crisis on these particular problems of capacity and coordination within the Greek government? The literature on crisis management across the social sciences often suggests that crises centralize decision-making and can empower the leader in an organization. Crises legitimize emergency action. Emergency politics prompts new thinking, new attitudes, new processes. As my colleague at the LSE, Jonathan White, has written, emergency politics creates a new terrain. People look to the prime minister to tell them what the crisis is, what it means, and what needs to be done. The crisis response of government creates a new network of actors tackling the problem, and they look to the prime minister for authority to act. Normal structures of government may be circumvented. The cabinet structure may be sidelined by a new network of actors tackling the crisis. Crises require firefighting, and the formal structures of consultation, decision-making are difficult to maintain. So our question then is, did the debt crisis change the inherited format? Did the machine operate differently during the crisis? And was the prime minister made more powerful because of the crisis conditions? Could we have the next slide, please?
Yeah. Can you see the slides all right, Kevin?
Yeah, I can indeed. Thank you.
Right.
Thank you. So, but if we can go to the next slide, please.
Sorry. I'm having a bit of trouble sharing my screen. That's the... Can you see it now?
No, I think if you point the cursor on slide 3, it may come.
I think that I I'm sorry, we're having some connection problems here. I'll just exit the meeting for a minute and come back again, if that's okay.
Yeah, I'll speak to the next slide.
Right, anyway. Okay, that's fine.
Okay. So what I was about to say was that given our empirical focus, we have a conceptual frame. And this conceptual frame draws on two different literatures. In political science, studies of comparative politics, and more generally, crisis management studies. From political science, comparative politics, we draw on the concept of a core executive, and you can now see the slide on your screen, thank you. The concept of a core executive was developed by Patrick Dunleavy and Rod Rhodes in the UK, and it is a fluid conception of the power relations between the Prime Minister and cabinet governments. Essentially, it asks, who is determinant in conflicts between different elements of the government machine? And we found in our 2015 book that the Greek core executive, the system of prime ministerial cabinet government, could be defined as being segmentary. That is, it has a fragmented problem-solving capacity. The conditions seemed endemic. And because they seemed to be prevalent across all governments we looked at from 1974 to 2009, the study left unanswered a critical question: when and how the system might change. Can these conditions, this fragmented problem solving capacity, be overcome? The second conceptual literature we want to draw upon is from crisis management across the social sciences. And here we draw upon the concept of a crisis response network. Essentially, this means those actors who are directly involved in the crisis response. It's a concept drawn from crises in different contexts. For example, we might think of an environmental disaster and the deployment of emergency services to tackle it. A crisis response network. It's created ad hoc to respond to the special conditions of a crisis. The network could potentially involve new actors, domestic or foreign. Certainly, the response network may operate on the basis of different kinds of processes. So in this context, the question then becomes, who does the leader authorize? Who does the leader include, seek advice from? Does the Prime Minister, in our case, seek diverse advice, different expert opinion, in order to come to the best strategies? Is there a risk of groupthink? In other words, those around the Prime Minister thinking the same, not thinking outside the box, as it were. There is a risk that groupthink might, in those circumstances, distance the Prime Minister from the rest of the cabinet structure, which could undermine questions of legitimation of the crisis response. So essentially what we're saying is that the operation of the crisis response network, how the crisis response network acts, can be determinant for the power of the Prime Minister in a crisis. Let me pass to Dimitri.
Okay, thank you very much, Kevin, and apologies for the technical glitch earlier on. Sophia, if we move on to the next slide, and following Kevin's introduction, let me just come with a spoiler alert here to say that certain things that we are not trying to do, and there are three things we are not trying to do. The first and most obvious is this is not a study about who was the best leader. Neither is it a study about who was a better negotiator, or indeed a study of how the respective memoranda of understanding came to be. To answer the first question, of course, I'm not sure how you would do it in a political science context. You might be able to do it in a beauty contest, but not so easily in a political science framework. Again, to answer the question, who was the better negotiator, you need also to feature in the discussion the opposite side, the tremendous power asymmetries between the Greek government and its creditor. And of course, to answer the question in more detail about how the memorandum came to be, you also need, of course, to speak a lot more about the creditors themselves and their internal negotiating processes, because these were, let's face it, absolutely fundamental of how the memorandum came to be. So what we are doing here, and that's the next point, is that we are trying to answer a specific question about centralization and control within the Greek government. The answer to that question, of course, is related to the three things that we are not trying to do, but we acknowledge here, and we want to make that absolutely clear, that we do not trying to address any of the three first points head on. If we can move to the next slide, please, and just for me to, and the next one, for me to return in a way to what Kevin said before. What is the premise of our comparison? Well, for the purpose of this article that we are writing right now, we are focusing on the first 6 months of the premiership of George Papandreou and Alexis Tsipras. Now, one may say, why choose this, the first 6 months? Don't you really compare an incomplete story? Well, yes, in a way we do, but we also find that these first 6 months for the two premierships share a lot of common characteristics. In political science lingo, we have a common independent variable. And that is, of course, that both governments at the beginning of the tenure, new prime ministers, under tremendous internal and external pressure with money running out. What is that we're trying to assess? What is our dependent variable, if you like, is, as I said earlier on, and Kevin has said it already, is the impact of this crisis on the ability of the government to control and coordinate, and particularly the ability of the prime minister to control and coordinate its crisis response network. And we see the crisis as a shock to the system that could potentially produce different outcomes. One would be that the crisis transforms in some way the Greek core executive. It transforms the way in which the government does business. A second scenario is that it doesn't really affect it that much. It's the inertia, if you like, outcome that it doesn't push it one way or another. Or indeed, a third scenario is that the crisis actually fragments the already segmented nature of the Greek core executive even further. If we can move to the next point, I think that in order to answer this question in a systematic way, and we do that in the paper, and we'll come back to this in our conclusion, hopefully, is that we look at these two episodes, if you like, under Papandreou and Tsipras, focusing in particular on three key axes. One is the prime minister himself, and particularly the way in which they have interpreted the crisis they were facing. In many ways, different leaders can produce different interpretation of a crisis that would, to the outsider, appear to be similar, but also in the way in which that they apply themselves. And that's something that we talked a lot in a 2015 book, looking at premierships before the crisis, that of course, different prime ministers interpret the job differently, and therefore their task engagement with the job differs quite substantially. What we are also looking at the paper is, of course, the ability the competence perhaps of the Prime Minister to steer the crisis response network, give it a sense of direction, challenge it to produce a strategy and apply the Prime Minister's thinking on the ground and vis-a-vis the creditors, of course. And thirdly, and we feel quite importantly, we are also looking at the extent to which the crisis response network has been legitimized by the cabinet, because of course, Greece mercifully is still a democracy. The prime minister does not have a carte blanche to apply himself in any way that it wishes. There are constraints within the government. So the crisis response network, even if the prime minister is fully behind it, faces constraints within the cabinet. And that, of course, affects its ability to instigate change. A final point here, which relates to data collection, we feel, of course, if you can bring the next point up, Sophia, we have concluded a large number of interviews with key players of these two governments, including lengthy interviews with both prime ministers. Together we have accumulated over 70 hours worth of interviewing data. So we feel very privileged, and we are very, of course, thankful to many senior people within the government, and of course the two prime ministers for giving us time and being very patient with our questions, and in a way opening up to us in helping us to understand better how they interpreted and they saw the crisis and its possible possible solution. So, with that, I'll pass on back to Kevin, and he will be starting with the empirical findings for the Papandreou government.
Thanks, Dimitri, very much indeed. So, I hope you follow the project design. I think the project design is very clear. So what about our empirical cases? Now, inevitably, in a seminar presentation, with all of the time constraints, we can only summarize the empirical findings. But I think we're going to come to some clear conclusions. Let's start with this first leadership dimension of the interpretation of the crisis and the strategic direction that the Prime Minister gives to government to manage the crisis. What did Papandreou bring to his crisis management? Of course, the attributes that stand out are his cosmopolitanism, his experience in government, very much a leader who focuses on the big picture, a consensual style, a personality that in many ways may be regarded as bigger than Greece. He's known internationally very well, many international connections. And indeed, his instinctive internationalism militated against him accepting that Greece should be left isolated or that it couldn't converge with the rest of Europe. This was a matter of Greece's destiny and its best interests. Greece could not be left outside. Greece could not be isolated. And his narration of the crisis was intellectually sophisticated. After the collapse of Lehman Brothers on Wall Street in September 2008, the West, he argued, as did many others, needed a Keynesian-style stimulus. while Greece also needed to reform itself to converge better with the European Union. So the narrative was dualistic. It had an international dimension and a domestic aspect as well. And in the famous phrase that he was to enumerate, he said, Greece had a problem, but it was not the problem. Many, I would share this as myself, many would regard this as an excellent analysis of the crisis. But nevertheless, with this narration of the crisis, Papandreou was actually going to lose the battle of narratives with his EU partners. Instead, the European Union partners, of course, wanted to shift the blame to Greece alone. Berlin, as others have argued, wanted something close to biblical redemption. It was not a system problem, it was a failure in Athens. And domestically, Papandreou faced a backlash in these narratives. In the election campaign, he'd famously commented that there is money available for the government to act. In fairness to Papandreou, in the same context of that particular comment, he'd argued that the money would become available as a result of domestic reform. But in the narratives of the crisis, Papandreou was to be accused of giving in to the European Union in order to win credibility, and of talking the country down, talking about the levels of corruption in Greece, talking Greece down in international and European fora. And in terms of his narration of the crisis, there was also some uncertainty perhaps in how Papandreou defined or saw the crisis. Was it a matter of an immediate liquidity problem, or was it a problem of debt? His interpretation seemed somewhat inconsistent over those first 6 months. But also as a leader, I think there's some personal angst as the Prime Minister who was the first to face what was an unprecedented and huge crisis. And this clearly impacted on the direction that he was giving the government. He would say that he was prepared to carry the cross, that is, to do what was necessary in terms of the national interest. Famously, in May 2010, his allies saw him as letting the opposition off the hook. He didn't insist on the first bailout being voted by a special majority of two-thirds. This left the opposition off the hook. He didn't go for early elections, and later he chose not to go for a referendum. With any of those actions, Papandreou, it seems, could have defeated the opposition roundly. But rather than choosing the party advantage, as he saw it, he was placing the national interest higher. Nevertheless, his personal instincts, his own ideological preferences, must have weighed very differently. We were told a story of Papandreou walking into his parliamentary office, having seen protests on the streets of Athens, protests against his leadership. And he was said to have commented, "I can't have this. I'm a Papandreou." So clearly there was personal angst in how he saw the crisis. But let me pass to Dimitris for the next part.
Yeah, let's focus a little bit more on the Papandreou's crisis response network, and perhaps start with the obvious that, the obvious is that his network was very united. It was a team of people, well qualified, all seeing the crisis in similar ways. The prospect of Greece going on an all-out fight with the creditors was quickly dismissed. But at the same time, it was a very small network, and I think not many people know that in Papandreou's premiership, as indeed in Tsipras's and others, the number of people that were involved in dealing with the negotiations were not much bigger than a football squad, perhaps a football team, 11 rather than 18. Well, let's say 18. In the case of Papandreou, this sort of clustered around George Papakonstantinos's team as a Minister of Finance, George Zanias as the head of the Council of Economic Advisers became extremely influential, and as a personal advisor to Papandreou as well. Papandreou took Zanias to many European councils as his Sherpa, as his personal appointed advisor there. And also a third cluster, small cluster of people around the Payments Authority or the Audit Office, the Γενικό Λογιστήριο του Κράτους, under Sahinidis, and a small team. So a lot of it seems to speak of a small heroic leadership, something that, of course, has been a long-term feature of the Greek core executive even before the crisis. So let's keep that in mind, right? That a small group of people with a relatively limited access to expertise and resources faced a much more powerful counterpart abroad with technically much, much superior skills. The significant empowerment of the Ministry of Finance under Papandreou, again, that mirrors in many ways the Karamanlis years. Perhaps George Papandreou would not like that comparison, but the trust that Papandreou gave to Papakonstantinou was significant and empowered him a great deal, for good reasons, of course, in the same way that Alogos Koufis also enjoyed a very powerful position within the Karamanlis government, although other circumstances were different. But having said that, the team was cohesive, but the feeling of key positions within the administration in the early parts of the crisis was delayed as part of the open gov process and so on. There were a few weeks, perhaps months, which in this context are very, very important, of course, where the administration was not up to speed at a very early at a very early stage. Of course, Papandreou himself had a huge network of associates, advisors, some very significant people, US academics, former senior European policymakers. Lukas Papadimos was his advisor. So he did have access to a lot of expertise, some, in my opinion, better quality than other. And here I'd say that some of the US-based expertise, to my mind at least, seem to have underestimated certain dynamics within the Eurozone. But nevertheless, the network was there. Was this network ever put into a regular pattern of decision-making within the Greek government? The answer is no. And this is where perhaps George Papandreou resembled his father in many ways back in the 1980s, who also had a huge network of associates of high-profile academics around the world. But often this kind of advice tended to be chaotic, not fully embedded into a formal decision-making process, and certainly not very well-connected with the administration, something that we'll come back to for the Tsipras years as well. So there were also significant absences, and that's the next point. Of course, the relationship between the governor of the Bank of Greece and the Greek government at that time was not good. Neither had Greece had an IMF representative during the early parts of the crisis. Roumeliotis came into the picture a few months later. Was that significant? Well, not so much for Roumeliotis, because Papandreou had established connections with Strauss-Kahn during that time. But nevertheless, it was a crisis response network that did not include all key players. And that is quite important. Final point here, the network did indeed speak the creditors' language. They were not seen as alien by the creditors, and that's important, particularly when you compare it with the Tsipras year, where the opposite side mistrusted massively the Greek side. But nevertheless, it is important to remember that at no point during this early part of the crisis, the Greek government developed its own blueprint and its own clear strategy of how it saw Greece coming out of the crisis. And that was significant because it led a lot of it left a lot of initiative on the creditors to determine both the problem and the solution to that problem. And both of these things were slightly problematic. And next slide, talking about the legitimation of the crisis response network by the Greek government, within the Greek cabinet. I think it's important to say that Papandreou's cabinet as a whole was not so fractious, at least not during these first 6 months of his premiership. Did they give the crisis response network? Did they give Papakostandinou, who in many ways led that network, all of their support? The answer is no. They didn't fully buy in into the process. They were reluctant. They were not fully committed, but neither did they openly undermine it, at least not publicly. It is also worth noting here that the first memorandum was approved unanimously by the Greek by the Greek cabinet, and PASOK's parliamentary party back then held quite well. There were only three defections in this first 6 months. So not a huge crisis, certainly not the kind of crisis that we saw subsequently in late 2010 and early to mid 2011. Papandreou himself mobilized his ministerial council, the Υπουργικό Συμβούλιο. I think that he was inclusive in that sense. He also held a lot of informal meetings with key ministers, but there was always a problem there, wasn't there? That the finance minister was a newcomer. He had, for many PASOK heavyweights, sort of jumped the queue. That was not very well received, and his support within the cabinet was never that important. Final point when it comes to the cabinet is that the buy-in and certainly the coordination of the Greek government during these first 6 months was in many ways damaged by time pressure. A lot of that had to be done very quickly. It was not pretty. You might recall certain senior ministers within the government saying that they didn't have time to read it, that they didn't have time to think about alternatives and so on. That was important, not so much for the first 6 months, because as I said earlier on, there was no mortal challenge to Papandreou's authority during that time, but it became a very degenerating feature during the implementation phase of the the first memorandum that eventually cost George Papandreou his job, and ultimately cost George Papakostandinou's job, and ultimately cost George Papandreou's job too. So over to Kevin.
Thanks indeed. So let's make a quick switch here to the second of the case studies. Of course, the leadership attributes of Alexis Tsipras were very different from those of George Papandreou. So what did Alexis Tsipras bring to crisis management? Well, of course, the public narrative was very stark and clear. The task of government was a matter of resistance, and this appeal had enabled Syriza to mop up much of the electoral support, or some of the electoral support, from the mainstream parties in previous years. The appeal was the end of the bailouts, the end of the pneumonia. Famously, in January 2015 on TV, Alexis Tsipras had said, they will back down. Believe me, they will back down, referring to Greece's creditors and EU partners. And with this, Greece would be able to stay in the Eurozone. Syriza, more widely, was to lead a fight back against neoliberalism in the European Union and was to link up with other progressive forces like Podemos in Spain. Now, unlike Papandreou, in a sense, time was on the side of Alexis Tsipras. Time to prepare the strategy. This was a chosen fight of resistance in coming to power. In principle, there was time to prepare the strategy and the options. And Tsipras was a shrewd tactician, but he was also secure as a person in reflecting on his own limitations, and indeed the limitations of his own party. He recognized that he had no government experience. Most of his cabinets had no prior government experience. I recognized that he had limited economic expertise and very limited international exposure. For a party, Tsipras also recognized that the neo-Marxist roots of Syriza scared off some voters. So the party, to come to power, had to reach out. And on that basis, he appointed Yanis Varoufakis as his Minister of Finance, a popular, independent figure, a very good communicator on TV. Varoufakis could reach parts that Syriza couldn't. It could enable the party to win a wider support. And Tsipras even went to Texas to persuade Yanis Varoufakis to join his team. And Varoufakis, of course, as the world knows, quickly became the front man. Indeed, he became even more of the front man than Alexis Tsipras had necessarily expected. The prime minister ceded huge space to Varoufakis as Minister of Finance, practically outsourcing the crisis management, at least in its public dimension. But Alexis Tsipras was engaged, he watched, he monitored, and he listened. Tsipras, crucially, had not discussed with Varoufakis the alternative options. Crucially, there had been no discussion of a plan B if plan A didn't work out. No clarity on what the fallback position might be. So when the negotiations with the European Union were getting nowhere, there was no agreement on what should be done. Tsipras sidelined Varoufakis. He'd become a roadblock. The crisis management had to be reconfigured. And on the inside, if anything, the government machine became somewhat more messy. So a shrewd tactician, but to some extent, he was giving an unstable lead. Still, when we look back on those first 6 months of 2015, the questions for Alexis Tsipras remain. What did he know before coming to power? What didn't he know? And what did he learn? Not talking to Varoufakis about the strategic options magnified the consequences of Alexis Tsipras's own learning process, and they disrupted the impact on his own government. Dimitri.
Yeah, let's focus a little bit more on the crisis network of Alexis Tsipras. Again, there are similarities here in the sense that both Tsipras and George Papandreou relied on a relatively or quite small response network. But unlike Papandreou, Tsipras's response network was very fragmented from the beginning, partly because of the way it was put together. We don't have time to go into a lot of detail here, but Tsipras himself has later acknowledged that the way it was put together was problematic. It pitched key figures against one another, Varoufakis against Houliarakis, who was the head of SOE, Varoufakis against Dragasakis, who was the vice president of the government. Of course, the whole of the government against the Bank of Greece. the so-called economists team that was very much publicized in the run-up to Tsipras coming to power within Syriza. By the time Syriza was in Maximou, had already fractured. So the crisis network was very fragmented from the very beginning. It relied on limited resources. And this is another interesting paradox of Yanis Varoufakis, that we often associate him as somebody who was an all sort of a dominating figure, a larger than life figure. That is true in terms of his public sort of projection. But interestingly, Varoufakis did not insist on having many of his own appointments within the government, with the exception of perhaps Nikos Thodorakis. I don't think that there were that many people that were absolutely committed to Varoufakis' cause. So Varoufakis himself was peculiarly blasé about this. It could be perhaps be a reflection of his government inexperience. It could be a reflection of his arrogance, perhaps. You know, obviously, interpretations vary here. But the truth of the matter is that, like Papandreou before him, Syriza's access to expertise in the government was relatively limited. And of course, Varoufakis, like Papandreou, also maintained a very large network of external advisors, some of them similar to those of Papandreou, people like Jeff Sachs, for example, and Larry Summers. But again, the same problem. This was advice that was given ad hoc. It was never part of an overall strategy, never fully connected to the administration. And of course, the direction of the crisis response network, as Kevin already mentioned, was always compromised by the fact that Tsipras remained ambiguous about where he wanted Greece to go. That's the final point of this slide. Without having a very clear sense of direction, of course, the crisis response network could not respond in a coherent fashion. So finally, on Tsipras's cabinet, that's the next slide. Of course, the divisions within the crisis response network also mapped onto the cabinet, much more so than in the Papandreou government. Here we have different clans with different fractions within the government. You don't want me to go over it. I think most of you would recognize who I am referring to. Tsipras did not really mobilize that much his ministerial council. That's the second point, unlike Papandreou. But he was inclusive. I think that very few people would argue that Tsipras was a leader that did not include different opinions. He included perhaps too many opinions. He brought into these informal meetings at Maximou not only government ministers, advisors, but also party people in trying to carve out a consensus. But as we know, of course, that consensus was not easy to maintain, and Tsipras did little to carve it out. He stayed on the sideline. And of course, the final point here is that when it came to the crunch, when the government had to reach a deal with the creditors, the government fractured. The party fractured, and we know what happened subsequently. So that's as far as the Tsipras government goes. We can move on to the conclusion.
Okay, thanks very much indeed. If we could just hold that particular point there for the moment. We'd ask the question, what was the impact of the crisis in terms of internal coordination and control from the centre? And we're going to conclude here that in the three possible outcomes that we had posited, we have two of them. We don't have transformation. The crisis did not transform coordination and control from the centre in the Greek government. Instead, for the Papandreou government, we had inertia. That is, that the fragmentation of the core executive, which we had identified previously, was sustained, not made worse, not made that much better. For Alexis Tsipras, however, we find a retrenchment, even greater fragmentation. Clearly, in both cases, agency mattered for how the crisis was managed within the core executive. The leader narratives, the leader choices, the strategies, all counted. The decisions of the leader had consequences. All of this suggests that with different choices, centralization and coordination might have been more effective. But it's not clear from our two cases what might be the limits to centralization, the structural impediments. Greece isn't starting with a tabula rasa here. Leaders may be able to restructure, but how far they can overcome the problem is still to be determined. Across our two cases, we don't have a case of successful centralization or greater coordination. Dimitri.
Just to labor this point a little bit more than the next bullet point here, I think the critical in all of this is how the crisis response network was operationalized, right? And the extent to which it could serve as a conduit for change. We find that its legitimation within the government was limited. The steer by the prime ministers in both cases to the crisis response network was not clear, either big picture and a lack of clarity, like in the case of Tsipras. In the case of Papandreou, again, the crisis response network never really became embedded within the government. And that connection between outside expertise, government, prime ministerial, if you like, a backing of a small group of people to deliver, if it's not well embedded in the administration, it never works. It either produces grand ideas that fail, or it produces tremendous opposition within the cabinet, in which case it also fails. Next point.
Okay, so what are the implications here? In terms of the implementation of the memoranda under crisis conditions. A repeat, of course, that we've been looking at the first 6 months of the two governments, and clearly the politics of implementation differed in both cases. If we had extended the time perspective, we would have had somewhat of a different story. With the Papandreou government, it became more divided, some ministers not delivering. For Alexis Tsipras, we had a government that increasingly became transfixed by implementation. So the story may have changed somewhat with a longer time perspective. For the European Union, I think there are deep and very general issues and challenges here. And they go beyond the Greek case. Of course, in the Greek case, the problems of coordination and lack of central control inhibited the capacity to deliver policies, inhibited the delivery of the conditions enumerated in the pneumonia. And indeed, in the second bailout memorandum, these issues were taken up. Greece was required to give more attention to coordinating its policy implementation under the memorandum. But the questions go much wider than Greece. In a European Union of 27 very heterogeneous member states, there's a system problem here in terms of choice, accountability, and legitimacy. How can the European Union intercede into domestic political systems using conditionality, in this case, bailouts, and resolve these questions of who chooses, who decides, and is it legitimate? More recently, of course, the so-called European Recovery and Resilience Fund has moved the story on, but it's moved the story on on the basis of very light conditionality. And it's not clear in the medium term whether somehow the European Union system has learned from the cases that we're looking at, that if in some future Eurozone crisis, the EU would necessarily act differently. So there are very important system challenges here for how the European Union can support, intercede in domestic political systems and resolve these questions of accountability and legitimacy. Dimitri, for the last point.
Yeah, there are also, of course, important questions for Greece as well. The big question here is that, you know, me and Kevin have been banging on about this for more than a decade now. Does Greece need a more centralized government machine? And what does that tell us about today and about some of the controversies that the current government of Kyriakos Mitsotakis is facing, about the size of the prime minister secretariats and so on? The answer is that, yes, it does need a stronger centralization. Does it need a lot more political appointees to deliver it? I am not so sure. I think that the answer surely has to be that Greece needs an elite civil service corps at the heart of government to be able to respond public policy-making challenges. And I bring in the question that I've seen by George, the first question in our Q&A, that do we need a crisis management ministry? No, I don't think we do need a crisis management ministry. But what we do need is enough capacity at the heart of government to be able to deal with emergencies, because the different emergencies we never know in advance. Some of them are of economic nature. More recently, we've seen different types, of course. So the challenge, in a way, even after 10 years of memoranda, still remains. How can we improve the policy delivery and the policy articulation of the Greek government? And here, I think that the jury is still out. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both Kevin and Dimitri for what was a very rich presentation and what promises to be a very important piece of work, which I hope is going to be published very soon, because it cuts right to the core of a lot of the issues that have been debated in terms of the Eurozone crisis and Greece's participation in this Eurozone crisis and what individuals and groups did in Greece to tackle the Eurozone crisis. While I wait for a few more questions to trickle in on the Q&A function, I wonder if I could just take the liberty of asking you a question in three parts, maybe. You started off, and your article, in a sense, starts off by locating yourselves in the comparative politics literature and talking about crisis management within this comparative politics literature. Now, my own, if you want, academic and intellectual background is from international relations, where there is a literature on crisis management, but it deals, of course, with external crises. My first question to you is, does the nature of this particular crisis, which is a hybrid crisis, that is, on the one hand, it's an international crisis of the Eurozone, but at the same time, it's a domestic crisis, skew the nature of the debate in any way? Is the comparative politics literature appropriate to deal with this kind of hybrid crisis? So that's my first question. This is also reflected in what you said about George Papandreou, who said that Greece is, you know, Greece has a problem, but it's not the problem. This sums it up pretty well in terms of looking at the sort of hybrid nature of the crisis and whether the comparative politics literature on crisis management actually captures the nature of this crisis. The second point is also related in a sense, and my understanding of crisis management from an international relations foreign policy perspective, and especially rooted in the literature of the Cuban Missile Crisis, etc., where it originates, is that bureaucracies matter, institutions matter, structures of decision-making matter. Groupthink is the result of an interplay of institutional and bureaucratic interests and not just individuals. There's a bounded rationality, which is to do with what we know, which is filtered through certain mechanisms. And yet what you've presented with us today, which is fascinating, is to do with individuals. It's to do with Papa Constantinou and Varoufakis. It's to do with a loose constellation of personal advisors surrounding prime ministers. It's to do with perhaps the cabinet, but it's very little to do with other institutions and bureaucracies. And I'd like you to say a bit more about that. I mean, my understanding of it is because they don't exist necessarily, but I don't think you can ignore it completely in your analysis, and it may be worth considering this aspect of it. And the third point I'd like to raise in conjunction with this is, where is the ideology here? Of course, you presented your work in a very short period of time, and I'm sure that the end product will be much more steeped in the idea of an ideology. Here, the only ideology I sensed was this commitment of Tsipras to the left, and the left mustn't fail. This almost self-referential concern of the left that it has to be presented in certain ways and it has to succeed in certain ways. But is there ideology here? Is there ideology in the response of PASOK and Papandreou? Is there ideology involved in this crisis, this crisis response network, and how does it figure? I'm sorry that I've taken up so much of the audience's time, but I just felt that I needed to get these questions off my chest and ask you to engage in them.
Great. Dimitri, if I go for the first one?
Yeah, that's fine.
And then
that's
we alternate or whatever. Thanks, Spiro. These are very helpful comments indeed. And as you say, the crisis is exceptional because it's international. What does that mean? It means that there's perhaps a greater sense of confrontation. There's a them and there's an us. And there's the potential there for that external pressure acting to bring actors together. That is, victimhood can create a greater sense of unity. So in some respects, the external nature of the crisis, the European nature of the crisis, might have been expected to make integration, coordination, a stronger leadership at home more likely as people bought in. So I think the fact that we're finding that is not the case is actually in many ways much more telling. Let me stop so that I don't hog, and Dimitri, you respond to the second one.
Yeah, just a very, I think the question of groupthink, I really like that. You said that often groupthink is produced by institutions and bureaucracies, which you are absolutely right. But here we have a case, that is Greece, which does not have a bureaucracy at the heart of government. Greece, we've said it in previous talks, is the only European country, perhaps the only Western country, that does not have a single, I repeat, a single permanent civil servant at the heart of government, right? So in the absence of an institutional player at the heart of government, how do you get groupthink? Yeah, you can get groupthink when political leaders and senior ministers have a very similar mindset. That is probably the case between Papandreou and Papa Constantinou. But then they don't have a bureaucracy to challenge it and mitigate it. Or you have the exact opposite. The absence of a bureaucracy cannot mitigate the complete falling out between fractions in the government and in the crisis response network, which was the case for Alexis Tsipras. So I think that's an important thing for us to remember, and a key pathology here, right? That there is no permanence in the senior layers of the civil servant in Greece. The ideology thing, I think it's absolutely fascinating. What has ideology got to do with it? To me, right now, I haven't actually thought of it through, but I can tell you of a puzzle. I can tell you that in our sort of fieldwork, many Syriza, senior Syriza people would remind us, and they were right to do so, by the way, that look, we were the only party to conclude a memorandum. Not Papandreou, not Papadimos, Samaras was able to do a full memorandum, but we did it, right? And that comes from a left-wing perspective. Now, how does that, what does that tell us about ideology? I don't know, but to me, it's a puzzle. And it's something that also points to an empirical kind of a puzzle as well with regards to Alexis Tsipras. Very often, Tsipras is portrayed in the Greek media as the ultimate messing up guy. But I think this is unfair to him. Tsipras was a fast learner. And for a person with zero government experience, following 6 months of mess, to then come back and complete a whole program, well, I don't know that's necessarily a badge of honor, but it's certainly an empirical puzzle worth investigating. And I'll leave it to that.
I just had one sentence, because I agree with everything Dimitris has said very well indeed. On the second question about bureaucracy, I do find the Greek case fascinating. And I'm just going to add one sentence. As Dimitris says, this is a context which is very, very light in terms of permanence or continuity. However, there is something there continuous in a cultural sense. The expectations of how government should be run, the expectations of government, whether that extends across the political milieu somehow is a much bigger question. So there's an absence of a continuity of actors, but there's something there in terms of the cultural expectations, which creates some degree of continuity, even path dependency. Spiro.
Okay, thank you very much for your answers. I think some of my questions, and certainly your answers, are reflected also in the questions that have come rolling in on the Q&A. If I could just take one question to start off with, which follows on from the more sort of academic side of what we've been discussing in the last few minutes. Stella Lardy, our colleague from Queen Mary University and Pandan University, asks, what do your cases tell us about the crisis management literature, which is where I started off from as well? Would you say that their expectation to see centralization, which is a core component of what you've been discussing, during crisis is superficial and not based on empirical evidence?
The quick answer is yes. the quick answer is to
say
a bit
more,
that the cultural embedded norms of the type that Kevin mentioned, entrenched institutional pathologies and a political culture that lacks continuity, it's very adversarial, needs to refresh its political personnel and its expert personnel in a small country so regularly, are bound to defeat this urge to centralize. So I guess, in short, Greece proves that the centralization hypothesis is not a foregone conclusion.
Yes, absolutely. It's conditional. What are we saying in terms of the crisis management literature? We're saying that, of course, I hope we indicated at the beginning that the crisis management literature doesn't necessarily say that centralization is, inevitable. And I think what we've been trying to do is to elaborate some of the conditions in our case studies that makes this particular hypothesis very much dependent on the prevailing conditions.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me just take you down a slightly different route. We've got a couple of questions here from Christos Gallis and Professor Takis Yoakimidis, Emeritus Professor at the University of Athens, which bring the current Mitsotakis government into the picture. Oh. So Takis Yoakimidis asks, on the basis of your research into the structure and function of the Greek government, can you comment a bit on the epitelikon kratos of Kyriakos Mitsotakis, which is reflected in Christos Gallis' question about, you know, should there be more management? Should there be more technocracy and less politics, less ideology? Would that make for stronger central coordination and for better crisis response.
Kevin, do you mind if I go first on that?
Please do.
Yeah. That's a very good question. What does the current government policy delivery record tell us about all of this? I think that it's fair to say that Mitsotakis was one of the few political leaders who saw this problem of centralization early on. He very quickly after he became prime minister had all of the structures set out. I think in that sense, he was able to grasp the problem early on. I think, and I said that when asked during the first few months of his government, that in many ways, the success of Kyriakos Mitsotakis in that particular field is not so much how well his government delivers a policy, but also what legacy, institutional legacy, he leaves behind. And here we have a story of two chapters, really. I think that it is true to say that in terms of policy delivery, the Mitsotakis government in certain fields has done very well. You do get a sense that there is greater coordination, quicker delivery, and so on. But ultimately, I don't think that Mitsotakis has created a structure there that will outlive him. I think that what happened is that Mitsotakis had a lot of connections, like his father did. He was able to mobilize a very large number of very good people to serve his government. That's great. The government benefits from that. But has he created an elite civil service corps? I don't think so. I think in that sense, Mitsotakis, like his father, because when we wrote in 2015 his a chapter on Konstantinos Mitsotakis' premiership, we said that it was a peculiar mixture of tradition and modernity. Kyriakos Mitsotakis, it's also a peculiar mixture here, right? As somebody who gets the policy delivery stuff, who gets the idea of coordination and so on. But ultimately, he has been a conductor of a party political core, not the creator of a civil service corps.
Absolutely. It goes back to the first point, which was raised in terms of should Greece have a crisis management department? My answer to that would have been yes, and that we would call it the Prime Minister's department. But the problem, as Dimitris has said far better than I, is permanence as opposed to political appointees. It's a question of balance. Many European systems have large proportions of political appointees. No European system has the Greek pattern of no permanent appointees. So it's a question of tackling that. And of course, in a culture in which there are many distracting pressures, clientelism. Thanks.
Okay, let's take another question from a member of our audience, Odysseas Konstantinakos, who's a PhD student at the European University Institute in Florence. His question relates to parties and party structures rather than individuals and ideology. So he wants to know a bit more about your research, and he says that what he missed from your research is the party structure that may underpin control and empower its leader. So his argument in terms of his question is that Tsipras comes from a radical left party, proud of a particular kind of decision-making procedure within the party itself. And the decisions that he made in the context of the crisis were still bound by party checks and balances, whereby by comparison, the PASOK party structure is much more hierarchical, and that Papandreou was not really bound by the party and by perhaps different factions in the party to behave in certain ways. Did this something that was reflected in your interviews? Did you come across these kinds of themes and discussions? Is it something that you are dealing with in your research?
Richard, do you mind if I go first and then
please
come in? It's a very good point. Parties do matter, and I think I accept the, what you said in terms of the questioner's premise. We have two conflicting, contrasting party cultures. A Syriza party culture, which was born of collective decision-making, consensus, inclusivity, etc. Not a culture which is easily supportive of a strong prime ministerial lead. Incidentally, it's not supportive also of bringing in an outsider like Yanis Varoufakis, who hasn't proved himself within the party tradition, but is somehow an appendage to the party. And yes, by contrast, Yorgos Papandreou is clearly a far more dominant figure within PASOK. So parties matter at a cultural level, expectations of the leader. But I think what we're also finding is that beyond that, in terms of power and coordination within government, the differences of party were not necessarily as one would have expected. Dimitri.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I recall from interviewing people in the Syriza government that this cleavage of an outsider in the face of Yanis Varoufakis coming into the Syriza's economists team, as it was called, was very, very strong. That people saw Varoufakis being catapulted into the very top job from Alexis Tsipras did cause a lot of resentment, which was partly related to Varoufakis' own personal style, but it was not only about that. Because as I said earlier on, you know, Varoufakis was a very expansive player within the government, but he was also very modest in his ambition to populate government posts. So it is, I think it's a very good question. Party culture does matter, and the outside influence, particularly for Syriza, is an important point. On that, if you don't mind, Spiros, can I just pick up on a question by Alexandros Zachariadis?
Please do.
Who also talks about a similar issue, that of, you know, do we see evidence of continuity, administrative continuity between Papandreou and Tsipras? The quick answer here, and that's an important part of what we need to keep in mind, is that the degree of fragmentation, administrative fragmentation, experienced in the Greek core executive during these 10 years is astonishing. Not one single senior person dealing with the creditors survived more than one government. Very, very a few perhaps survived one. But the overall picture is one of a political and advisory personnel that came and went every time that the government changed. And during that time, we changed four governments. Imagine what that did to Greece's credibility in the eyes of its creditors. There is a fantastic anecdote here. There is one person that stayed relevant in the negotiation across all four governments. That is Papandreou, Papadimos, Samaras, and Tsipras. You know which a person that is? That's Glenn Keane, a Korean advisor that advised all Greek governments on debt restructuring and so on. So imagine, here we're talking about the Greek core executive and crisis management, and the only person that survived it all is a Korean. There used to be a joke about what the Koreans saw back in the 1980s. I don't remember that joke very well. I was not old enough, but some in the audience may remember. And it is a very telling parallel here, right? That only one person we can identify that was there throughout.
I think the mistress is being modest about his age, but let me just add that the lack of continuity costs. One of the criticisms that our interviewees in CIDISA mostly accepted was at the beginning they lacked knowledge of the European Union institutions. And one of the criticisms made, of course, is that they focused on the wrong parts of the EU. They overestimated the ability of the European Commission to persuade, overestimated the European Parliament in some ways, but they were looking in the wrong place. Now, as Dimitris has said, a bureaucracy that retains some continuity of officials, of some continuity of knowledge, would understand the map and would understand the channels and the processes and would offer some support for newcomers coming in, whatever their particular preferences.
Thank you very much. We have a number of questions here, both from our Facebook audience and our Zoom audience, which touch on the last point that you were making, Kevin, in terms of continuity. You don't necessarily have to answer these if you don't want to right now, but I'm just going to post them because they're relevant to what you've just been talking about.
Yep.
Philippos Papasavas says, why do you think Greece has not developed an elite permanent civil service while other countries in Europe have? Athina Markandoni, Euroscope Athens, asks, what kind of capacity is needed at the heart of government to deal with crisis more effectively? And is it possible to enhance capacity of civil servants that come and go together with governments? This question of continuity. So what you were just talking about is reflected in the concerns of the audience about what is it that's possible to establish at the heart of administration, which will give the kind of continuity and give the kind of permanence and institutional knowledge and institutional memory that may make dealing with crises more effective and more manageable.
I think it's Dimitris's turn to go first. I'm happy to.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I think in many ways we'll have an answer that kind of question in the title of our last book, which was Greek Prime Ministers, The Paradox of Power. A significant part of Greece's political culture is to see institutional constraints as something that makes policymaking dysfunctional and problematic. And seeing permanent administrative structures as something that cannot be trusted, because very often trust of the political leader to his followers and vice versa sometimes has to be unmitigated, right? So there is very little trust in permanent structures. That creates an illusion of power. That was the argument we're trying to develop in our last book, that to be an emperor is great, right? But to be a naked emperor or an emperor without clothes is not so great, because you can have all the power you want, personalize it as much as you want, but if you don't have the means, the institutional means, the policy means to implement it, it counts for nothing.
Kevin?
Eloquently put. I agree with that. What can I pick up on? I think I wouldn't wish as an Anglo-Saxon to be interpreted here as saying, well, you should adopt a particular model. You've all seen Malista Kyriopoye, yes minister on TV. I'm not, and I'm sure Dimitris is not, advocating a particular specific model here. And as the questioners have indicated, it's a matter of balance between permanency, between political appointees, etc. It's simply that the Greek case is at the end of a spectrum in terms of the lack of continuity. What capacity is needed to tackle a crisis? How long is a piece of string? We can't define that. What we're identifying, however, are problems in the crisis management. Let me make a point which Dimitris often quite correctly makes. nothing in our study is separate from recognizing that in the bailout negotiations from beginning to end, there was a tremendous power asymmetry between the creditors and the Greek government. We're not saying that with greater capacity, Goliath could have been slain. There was asymmetry. What we're saying is that the response could have been more effective. The response could have been better informed, and implementation would likely to be more efficient as well. But I repeat the point, this is not some kind of imposition of an Anglo-Saxon model. We have different models, whether in Berlin or Paris, which work very well indeed. The point is that Greece is at the end of the spectrum, and there are problems clearly on the basis of those who have been in governments and have recognized those problems.
Thank you very much. We are quickly coming to the end of our session, but I do want to take two more questions, if you don't mind. I'll put them to you, and perhaps each of you could address one of them and spend like a minute each answer, and that way we'll come to a natural conclusion. The one question is to takes us back to the idea of groupthink, and Professor Charalambos Tsarnadidis from the University of Aegean asks very succinctly if in the Papandreou administration there were elements of groupthink, and by comparison in the Tsipras government, polythink prevailed, which is a question reflected also in what Professor George Kazamias of the University of Cyprus has said in terms of the outcomes of policy being the diversity of the team of supporters in the Tsipras camp. So it's groupthink versus polythink. The last question I'd like to put to you is from Frank Brower. I don't have an affiliation here. The question is, when did austerity become the appropriate crisis management solution for George Papandreou and Alexis Tsipras? Or did they feel they had little alternative in terms of what is happening in the Eurozone and its links with the Greek bank? So, you know, when did austerity become the main narrative for both these administrations? Polythink, groupthink, and austerity is a narrative. Who's going to go first, gentlemen?
I can try and answer a little bit the austerity thing, perhaps. Look, neither Papandreou nor Tsipras chose austerity. I think that's an oversimplification of big proportions, right? I mean, they were confronted with an austerity narrative that they couldn't, with all goodwill, with all good coordination in the world, repel. I think that is absolutely clear to me. What I think is also true, that's something that Kostas Simitis has mentioned briefly in his book, and I think I agree with this. I think that there was more scope for the Greek government to produce its own blueprint on how it saw exit from the predicament early on. No Greek government, if you look on the internet, you will not find a document with the Greek government's logo on it to say, this is the Greek government's strategy to exit. The Greek government responded to demands of creditors to do things. Sometimes it responded more professionally. Sometimes it responded in a very infuriating manner, but always responded. We don't have, in 10 years of crisis management, a paper with the Greek government's seal on it to say what they wanted to do, right? And I think that's a problem. Why didn't it happen? I believe that it didn't happen because the Greek government, as indeed many other governments around the world, were overwhelmed by the pace of change during the early parts of the crisis. But it also happened because the Greek government has no capacity to produce a strategy which is so encompassing, which demands so many different changes to happen at a very short period of time, at such short notice. They can't do it. We don't have the capacity to produce strategies. So when the biggest challenge of all came our way, The best thing we could do, and we didn't do it always very well, was to respond. And that's a pity.
Absolutely. On the 2 points in terms of when did austerity take over, or when did the leaders accept austerity, it's clearly the battle of narratives and Greece losing that particular battle. Both leaders, given the asymmetries, were obliged to accept the deal or exit, and neither wanted to exit. On the point about groupthink or polythink, it's a nice way of putting it. Yes. The short answer is yes. I think one of the things that we would, however, mention here are the stages of the crisis. Given the longevity of the crisis, polythink was far more likely to occur at the end than at the beginning. At the beginning, the natural response is to be caught in the headlights of the crisis. And to firefight rather than thinking perhaps more widely. But I very much agree with what Dimitris has said in terms of capacity. It goes to the point about lack of ownership. Other countries in the bailout conditions did develop ownership, did have a document which said this is our plan. And I think in some ways that is related to the issues that we've been talking about institutional incapacity.
Right. Thank you very much. I think we've now run out of time and used up our allotted time. So I'd like to bring proceedings to an end. I'd like to thank, in the first instance, our audience, both for tuning in to this fascinating seminar and also for providing us with a list of very interesting questions, which I think both Kevin and Dimitris did their best to answer. Could I just remind the audience that as this has been recorded, it will duly be available on the HO website and also on the Hellenic Observatory YouTube channel in the near future. So if you want to catch up on this event and others, please feel free to visit our website and our YouTube channel and listen to the podcast and view the event all over again. A bit of advertising. We have an upcoming event in the Hellenic Observatory online on Monday, the 31st of January at 1600 UK time, at 4 p.m. UK time. The topic is religion and human rights in Greece. The speakers are Effie Fokas, who's a senior research fellow at ELIAMEP, the Hellenic Foundation for European and Foreign Policy in Athens, and Yanis Ktistakis, who's a judge of the European Court of Human Rights. The event will be chaired by Kevin Featherstone. As I said, it's on Monday, the 31st of January at 4 p.m. We hope to see you there. And I'd like to just conclude by thanking both Dimitris and Kevin very much for sharing their preliminary findings with us. I find this to be a fascinating paper, and I wish you all the best in your publication in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you to everyone. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.